Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Today, more people are getting a glimpse behind the veil of what we think of as reality. They're having a crack in the sky moment during their daily meditation, or yoga class, or on a psychedelic journey, or maybe even just walking down the street on a bright spring day. Suddenly, their materialist assumptions are exposed as illusions. Their very idea of self is revealed to be an illusion. Their old clothes don't seem to fit, nor does their job, or even relationships. And they're recognizing that we live in an era of reinvention. The opportunities are huge. The challenges are real. You're just in time for the evolution. Welcome to The Evolver, where each week I talk with inspiring pioneers of the new consciousness culture. If you're into what we're doing here, please subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, Acast, or on the podcast app of your choice. Share this episode with buds at the Metaphysical Book Club. Leave a rating on iTunes and post about it on social media. Our email address is theevolver@evolver.net. You can follow us on Instagram at The Evolver Podcast and on Facebook at Evolver Social Movement. Now, let's get started.
Welcome to The Evolver, sponsored by The Alchemist Kitchen, hosted by Ken Jordan.
At the moment when our planet is faced with ecological meltdown, in the midst of what scientists call the sixth great extinction, something extraordinary is happening. Plants from the most biodiverse area on Earth are sending up a flare to get our attention, realigning our focus onto what really matters in life. Our religious traditions, and then the cold-eyed gaze of science, have somehow led us away from honoring and respecting the intelligence of the plant kingdom. But now that we're on the verge of possibly wiping ourselves out, the wisdom of plants is reasserting itself. The unfortunate fact is that most of us can't go to visit the Amazon rainforest ourselves. The forest couldn't handle 7 billion primate tourists anyway. Instead, the forest sent an emissary to come visit with us. That messenger, ayahuasca, is the remarkable product of a vine and a leaf, brewed into a tea so thick and acrid that no one in their right mind would be called to drink it for the taste. But the message that comes through the drinking experience is so clear, you put up with the taste. Remarkably, that message from the emissary of plant intelligence is not one of panic, not one of fear, not one of anger and retribution. Rather, it lays out a path of healing, understanding, and forgiveness based in an all-embracing love. It connects you to your heart. It reminds you that you are divine and immortal. Of course, most of us don't want to hear that, because embracing this understanding as your reality means relinquishing a slew of assumptions about what it's supposed to matter in your life. Everything's turned upside down, like having your house ransacked. But then you realize you never really needed that old house anyway. Our society is due for a massive reshuffling of priorities, with healing moving to the central position. By healing, I don't mean only addressing your personal wounds, though that's certainly a big part of it. But there's a violence that humanity has been inflicting upon nature, on the great mother who gave birth to all of us, which no longer serves us. And that healing is going to require a great deal of attention. At the same time, that call for healing is an invitation to a way of being that offers each of us a path towards infinite growth. It's actually pretty cool when you stop to think about it. Saving the planet is also the best way for you to connect personally to your divine self. These are the kinds of realizations that come when you walk the plant spirit medicine path. No one owns this understanding. It's quite frankly common among the folks who commit to this kind of work. I was so tickled to discover that I shared much of this perspective, which I just laid out, with my guest today, Josh Radner. You're always happy when you find a fellow traveler, but as you're about to hear, the downloads we've received are pretty parallel. I really got a kick out of that. Josh is one of those people who you think, he's so good at all these things. Is that allowed? He starred in a hit TV show, How I Met Your Mother. He starred in a Broadway play, Disgraced, that won a Tony for Best Play. He directed two films, including Happy Thank You, More Please, which won the Sundance Film Festival Audience Award and was nominated for the Grand Jury Prize. He writes books, the first of which he pulled back from the publisher because he talked too honestly in it about the stuff that we discussed today on the show. He's a musician, and he's in a band with the great Ben Lee. Their first album, Radner and Lee, was released in 2017. He's currently acting in a new show for Amazon, The Hunt, produced by Jordan Peele. On top of all of this, as you will hear, he's a mensch. I met Josh through our mutual friend, Brett Kaufman, who we mentioned, and who I also hope to have on the show sometime in the not-too-distant future. This was my first conversation with Josh, and I wasn't prepared for where it was going to lead. I knew he meditated, and I saw a reference to him and ayahuasca somewhere up on the internet, but I didn't realize he had such a deep and thoughtful relationship to plant spirit medicine. One important note, because we're clearly having so much fun talking about our shared passion for the brew, I want to make sure to get across an important point. Psychedelics in general, and ayahuasca in particular, are not for everyone. You can have an incredibly powerful mystical experience without psychedelics. I know many people whose connection to source and to visionary experience does not involve ayahuasca or anything else that they imbibe, and I've had a bunch of them on the show. For some people, psychedelics are really not helpful. I just have to be honest about that. But I also don't prescribe to the attitude that the psychedelic experience, particularly with plants, is a cheap shortcut of some kind. I have found it to be the opposite. The universe is awash in profound spiritual energies. Some of the greatest teachers available to us monkeys come from the spirits of plants. And believe me, they have more to teach than we're capable of learning over the course of a mere 100 years. Everyone seems to be talking about CBD these days, that is, cannabidiol, the non-psychoactive component of cannabis. The buzz is that CBD doesn't make you high, like THC does, but for conditions such as stress and anxiety, health professionals are increasingly recommending it as an alternative to pharmaceuticals, and scientific research is showing that CBD is highly anti-inflammatory, so it can help with pain relief. What does the scientific research say about CBD? Research centers in the United States and elsewhere are studying the effects of CBD on a variety of ailments. Scientists refer to CBD as a promiscuous compound because it offers therapeutic benefits in many different ways while tapping into how we function physiologically and biologically on a deep level. Extensive preclinical research and some clinical studies have shown that CBD has strong antioxidant, anti-inflammatory, antidepressant, antipsychotic, and neuroprotective qualities. What's the best way to take CBD? CBD-rich cannabis oil products can be taken sublingually, orally, as edibles, lozenges, beverages, tinctures, and gel caps, or applied topically. Concentrated cannabis oil extracts can also be heated and inhaled with a vape pen. Inhalation is good for treating acute symptoms that require immediate attention. The effects can be felt within a minute or two and typically last for a couple of hours. The effects of orally administered CBD-rich cannabis oil can last for 4 hours or more, but the onset of effects is much slower, like 30 to 90 minutes, than inhalation. Evolver is the proud papa of the Alchemist Kitchen, a botanical dispensary located in the Bowery District of New York, where you can find the finest quality CBD products available without THC. We also make our own premium CBD under the Plant Alchemy label. Our producer Jose's mom uses it for stress, anxiety, and high blood pressure. Our plants are grown in both field and greenhouse environments, cultivated using living soil organic principles, leveraging strictly organic inputs, and in full compliance with the controls defined by the Colorado Department of Agriculture. Our plants are some of the highest CBD cannabis varieties currently known. You can find out more about CBD by visiting the Alchemist Kitchen website at thealchemistskitchen.com. There's an S in there. And searching for CBD. There are articles on the blog, an FAQ, and a selection of vetted products. Or stop by our spot at 21 East 1st Street in Manhattan, between Bowery and 2nd Avenue, and talk to one of our staff herbalists. At the shop, tell them you listen to the Evolver podcast and receive a 10% discount on any product on the shelves. So did you meditate today?
I'll tell you something. I did, but not as long as I liked.
How long do you like to?
20.
And was it?
It was under 10. Yeah. I had to get out the door.
You do it once a day, twice a day?
You know, I was a twice daily meditator for years and years and years. Mm-hmm. And now I'm like a once maybe daily meditator. And on rare occasions I do too. But
what happened?
I don't know. You know, part of it was, and I'm just coming up with this in this moment, but I think is probably true, is that I've been such a good student my whole life. I'm such a diligent doer of things. Mm-hmm. And I think I've been experimenting with, if I don't meditate twice a day, I'm going to live and still thrive. You know what I mean? Like the non-doing has been important to me. Like just to experiment with like, oh, I don't need to do that twice a day like the TM teacher taught me, or else I would fall into an abyss. I was sick the last 2 days, and I find it very hard to meditate when I'm sick. So I think I had a little bit of like sick restlessness this morning. But I'm a semi-diligent meditator.
So TM is what spoke to you?
It's just what I learned.
You ever tried anything else?
No, I want to do a Vipassana, but I'm terrified of it.
10 days of silence.
Or even three days scares me.
Oh my God. No, yeah. I've never tried it.
Yeah. It scares me.
No, I aspire to. What I really want is the 10 days.
Yeah.
Then I might be able to do it.
My best friend from high school, who Brett knows really well, he's done 2 or 3 of the 10 days. And he always comes back kind of, newly born. Do you know that book Sapiens? You know that?
Oh, of course, yeah.
So that say writer.
That writer. Yuval
Harari, I think his name.
Yeah, I think that's right.
He does a 3-month Vipassana every year in India, November, December, and January. And then he writes and tours and teaches, I think, for the rest of the 9 months. And everyone in his life knows that it's non-negotiable. It's not questioned. He just does this 3-month Vipassana. And the craziest thing was in 2015 going into 16, he didn't know Donald Trump had been elected until the last day of January, because he was in this 3-month meditation.
You almost get jealous. Oh well, yeah, yes.
he had a little bit longer than we had.
I mean, yeah, I sort of think maybe the world is saner than you thought it was.
Yeah,
that 3 months.
I like the idea that he's obviously so prolific and at the top of his game. And he's got 9 months of the year to work with him, and he takes 3 months to just saturate in whatever.
So. Well, you know, and maybe that's what most of us need, is to actually figure out how
to do less.
How to do less well.
What's that phrase they say? Do much, achieve little, do less, achieve more, do nothing, achieve everything. You ever heard that?
I haven't, but I like it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the closest I get to is, I didn't have enough time to write you a short letter, so I wrote you a long one.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm always navigating kind of how I could do a little bit less. Like one of the things I found in acting is older actors are incredibly compelling, but you can't, they seem to be doing nothing. They seem to be doing a lot less than the young actors who are really like, you know, singing for their supper. I'm working with Al Pacino right now on this show, and it's like unbelievable to be up close to a guy who just is... I mean, obviously he's a world-class talent, but you know, there's something about older actors. They don't waste any energy and they just do. There's a life lesson in that.
That's interesting, because especially when he was younger, he could be pretty energetic.
Yeah. And he still has some of that. Like you can see that kind of electricity behind the eye, but he's older. So his movements are much more economical.
That's so cool. Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's actually a good part of, you know, sort of life lesson.
Yeah.
You begin to, you know, over time, let go of the extraneous stuff.
And I think nature takes care of some of that for you, in that you don't have as much energy, simply. So you manage your energy a little bit better. I also found, you know, there's something fascinating to me about aging, is that I used to be able to sleep in until like 12:30 or 1. And now I can't sleep past like 7 at 7:30. So I feel like it's nature's way of just getting you to enjoy the mornings.
That may be part of it. Yeah, you don't have kids yet.
No.
That will definitely do it. Yeah. Oh my God. I haven't seen the other side of, you know, basically, you know, 6:15, 6:30. Yeah. We're up, man.
Yeah.
It happened.
But I didn't even know I liked the mornings, much less that they existed until a couple years ago when I just found I couldn't sleep in anymore.
That is kind of, and then you were at the same time drinking less?
Yeah.
That may have something to do with it.
Yeah.
Because I used to have to sleep it off.
Totally.
Yeah.
I don't know. My body wanted less to know alcohol the older I got. I can feel that. Yeah.
Well, did you find that the TM had anything to do with
it? A little bit. It coincided a little bit. I think I started doing TM in 2003 or 4. And then my first kind of spate of not drinking, I didn't drink for about 4 years, starting in 2007. 2008. So yeah, I mean, yeah. And then I kind of went back and decided to drink a little bit for 2 years and that didn't work. And then I didn't drink for 3 years and then I tried it again. And it just didn't work. It doesn't work.
Well, and so what came first? Was it TM or ayahuasca?
TM. Ayahuasca is the reason I stopped drinking though.
I was going to ask.
Yeah.
The reason I stopped drinking.
Do you find that that plant hates alcohol?
Yes.
Absolutely. Well, I found that over and over again.
What I found, well, it may well hate alcohol.
Yeah.
But it was more that it was sensitizing my body to the poison that is alcohol.
Correct.
So as I would drink, I hadn't noticed what it was doing to me. And then suddenly I realized, oh my God,
right.
I was conscious and now I'm getting numb. And I'm getting numb because there's this weird thing that the alcohol is doing to my body.
Right.
And I can feel the heaviness.
Right. Yeah. I also tend to think of it as like, you got to decide if you want what you drink to make you more conscious or less conscious. And I felt like ayahuasca was contributing to a heightening of consciousness and the alcohol was degrading my consciousness.
Totally.
But what happened was I was, so I went to Brazil and I drank, like, I did 6 ceremonies in Bahia on the northeast coast of Brazil.
What kind of ceremony? Do you remember?
It was with a Colombian shaman, just on the beach, like long ceremonies, you know, and kind of like stay up until the sun rose.
Sweet.
And it was gorgeous. Yeah. And then I went to Colombia with the same group in Armenia, this in the jungle. And on my second ceremony, which would probably be the 8th ceremony I ever did, my whole evening was about my drinking. It was not on my radar to stop drinking.
Huh.
And I saw how hooked it had me.
How much were you drinking then?
I was drinking enough to have an evening about ayahuasca that examined my drinking. You know what I mean? And it wasn't, when I quit drinking, a lot of people were like, I wasn't a bad drunk. You know, I was a charming drunk. I was like, I was fine. I didn't, you know, but what, interestingly, so I did these 6 ceremonies. I came back for the summer and I had this really sloppy, messy evening with this woman in Columbus, and she had a boyfriend, which I didn't quite care about because I was off the rails, right? And I got punched in this parking lot at the end of the night twice. And really, my nose, I was bleeding all over my mom's car. Like, it was really dark. By the boyfriend. Yeah, he kind of jumped me in the parking lot at the end of the night when I dropped her off.
This is kind of like, was it a deja vu moment from the show? I remember you had a...
Which show? How I Met Your Mother?
Didn't you get hit by a boyfriend?
I got punched a couple times.
Yeah, I remember there was a boyfriend moment.
There were some weird things where things would happen to me that happened on the show or vice versa. Like, things would happen to me and then they'd happen in the show. It was very strange.
That was scripted into the show before anybody
knew that it was part of your life. I was punched on the show after I had been punched in life, I think.
Okay.
If we're thinking of the same thing. You know, that was part of my evening, was examining, like, oh, I was so drunk. I never should have been driving. You know, it was a really dark evening in my life, right? Yeah. And so I had this whole evening that was, you know, there was Native American imagery. And the other thing was I had just moved into my house and I had a barbecue on the 4th of July. And I hadn't moved in yet, but I had a barbecue at the house. And my friend and I, she since stopped drinking, also not long after, we went to like a BevMo or whatever, and we bought, there were probably 50 people, but we had alcohol for like 120. Like, we had so much alcohol. And I realized when I was in Colombia that my house was filled with nothing but alcohol. I had moved nothing in there, but this leftover alcohol was there. And I thought, oh, interesting. That's the first thing I moved into my house.
Ooh.
Was all this booze.
Yeah.
So, and you know, I have alcoholism in my family, and it just at a certain point, it started to feel like I was more committed to the medicine work and all that work. And it felt like I was trying to have both worlds. And at a certain point, I felt like I was being asked to choose, you know?
That's powerful.
Yeah, it really was.
Was it hit in the moment when you were down? Or I guess when you come back, you'd had that,
you know,
literally.
I felt like I was being asked / invited to stop drinking. And I called my friend who got sober when I was in grad school at NYU. And he's a dear friend of mine, still one of my best friends. And I called him from the Miami airport and I said, I think I'm supposed to stop drinking. And I started crying because I was like, it was so emotional for me, the idea that I could have a social life without drinking. I was just a guy who ordered drinks everywhere, you know? So he said a great thing. He said, nature loves a vacuum. And you take away all that energy and all that psychic space and everything you're doing, something else is going to come in. And interestingly, my career took some changes after that. Like I, you know.
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah, I started directing films.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You think that wouldn't have happened if you were still drinking?
Who's to say, you know? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, I think that the, I've gathered enough research. And again, I'm hesitant because I drank a little bit last year. I'm hesitant to like get on podcasts and say, I don't drink. And someone's going to see me with a glass of wine and be whatever. But, you know, from where I am right now, I've done enough research to know like alcohol and me is not a great combo if I want to live a kind of creative, engaged, conscious life that I'm aspiring to.
That's so cool. Did you find you were doing TM before you went to Brazil?
Yeah.
In my ayahuasca experience in New York,
yeah,
every so often, folks will show up who do transcendental meditation.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, you know, when I was young, I did psychedelics, and that's what turned me on to spiritual stuff.
Right.
When I started doing TM, you're not supposed to be doing that.
Right.
Don't tell anybody I'm here. You know these three other people in my TM circle.
Yeah.
Never mention to them
yeah.
that I am here with you tonight drinking yeah. ayahuasca.
I've been in enough spiritual groups that have like rules and boundaries and borders and regulations that I don't buy any of it. Like I feel, first of all, I learned outside of the TM umbrella. I learned from a kind of rogue teacher. To be honest, I think he's a terrific meditation teacher, but at a certain point I had to leave him just as I've had to leave every spiritual teacher I've ever been with. I sometimes feel like, and again, I mean, if you learn from him, you'll learn a good practice. But I sometimes feel like people are trying to create a container or a thing that will make you want to go, don't tell anyone I'm here. Don't tell anyone I'm doing this. Or, you know what I mean? It becomes mm-hmm. like there's a group think that starts to happen. And I was very deep in a spiritual community that was like ayahuasca based for years with a Peruvian guy. And it got, I had to leave it and I'm still processing it. And I left about 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago. So I'm just very suspicious of the group mind, you know, and it took me a while to wake up from certain spells I think I was under.
But I think everybody, I think that's a healthy impulse. That's a really healthy impulse.
Yeah. You know, there's that phrase, that Lao Tzu quote that everyone quotes all the time, but they miss the second part of it.
Oh, what's
so
that?
The first part is when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. The second part of it, less quoted, is when the student is really ready, the teacher will disappear.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. So I found that part of my journey around these teachers and these spiritual groups is the leaving of them is a powerful moment in the teaching. And I feel that any teacher who is creating a dependency and not empowering you to go out, you know, like I think Adyashanti, you know, that spiritual, he's a Buddhist spiritual teacher. You know, he was told at one point by his teacher, like, get out, like, you got to leave the monastery and go teach now. You got to get out of here. And I feel like that's a wise teacher who kicks you out of your comfort and who also says you're becoming too dependent on me, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's also a healthy teacher who isn't playing into the ego game.
Exactly.
Of the
exactly.
power trip of
and I've
needing
been,
the people to
I've
come to
I've been so
door.
Hooked by teachers. So hooked. And part of it is this, you know, everything is, part of it is a sweet impulse, which is like, I'm a good student. I recognize that the world is madness and my mind is madness and I need some guidance and some help. But the darker part of it is, you know, shame or a feeling that I can't do this without some like steady hand, you know? And part of growing up for me has been saying, like, I think I know enough to stand on my own two feet. And I don't recommend that to everyone. I mean, I think some people really need, I would recommend certain people, like, no, find a community, get a teacher. Mm-hmm. But for me, there were these painful kind of what felt archetypal, you know, it was time to go.
Yeah. Actually, what I think is going on, and I kind of have a quirky vantage point from doing the sort of work I've been doing for the last few years, is that an awful lot of people are doing what you do. They're going into one modality and another, maybe simultaneously. They're doing the TM and the ayahuasca or whatever. They're doing some meditation and a plant-based, you know, sort of exploration. And maybe they're also learning Qigong at the same time. And then they're moving between different modalities and they're weaving things together. And you stay with one thing for a while as you go deeper with it. And you're discovering what the underlying truths to it are.
Yeah.
And then something else is calling and then something else is calling. And I was talking about this with Jon Kabat-Zinn, meditations teacher.
Yeah, I love his books. Yeah.
He's an amazing guy.
Yeah.
A couple of weeks ago. And his immediate response to that was, well, you know, that's just like, you know, supermarket shopping.
Right.
Right. You're not committing to go deep in a lineage.
Right.
And that is how I kind of grew up hearing about these things.
Right.
Like the idea is that, in fact, you should commit.
Right.
But I got to say, I'm coming more and more around to the other way of seeing it, that there's something really powerful about not about going deep and being true to yourself and knowing what you need in order to grow.
Right.
But, you know, sampling all kinds of different modalities so that you can discover, in fact, what's underneath them beyond the sort of the cultural overlays.
Yeah. It's a little bit like someone saying, like, don't travel to lots of places, travel to one place and go deep into the culture. And it's like, well, it's really fun to travel to lots of different places. There's fascinating places on the earth and there's fascinating traditions and there's lots of tributaries pointing to the one ocean.
But it's also true that when you go to one culture, you only see what that culture is really interested in.
Right.
So like some cultures are really into spicy food,
right?
But they don't do ice cream, let's just say, right?
Right.
But you want to also like learn about ice cream. So
sure,
you gotta go somewhere
but
else.
But also, you know, I'm really clear on this idea that everyone's only ever talking about themselves. So Jon Kabat-Zinn is like, he's a mindfulness practitioner and that's what he's done and that's what he's gone deep in and that's what he's written his books about. And that's, so of course he's gonna advocate for that, you know, but I feel ultimately like, you know, I've studied the Vedas. I've been, you know, with the Keros tribe in Peru, and I've been to India to different ashrams and all these different things, you know, and they've all been powerful in their own ways. But I keep coming back to this idea, you know, there's this famous Aldous Huxley at the end of his life was asked, you know, at a lifetime of spiritual seeking, you've done it all. You've taken every substance. You've sat with every tribe. What did you get? Like, what's, if you could synthesize it, what did you get? And he said, you know, I'm a little embarrassed to admit, but this is it. Just try to be a little kinder.
Ooh.
Right?
Yeah.
And I really keep coming back to this, like, no fuss spirituality. Like, we all know people who are, you know, who have the altar and who have the whatever, but they're a mess or they're gossipy or they're, you know what I mean? Like, they feel out of integrity. But they're doing all the things. They're wearing all the costumes and all that stuff.
Yeah, of course.
And then I know people who, you know, wouldn't know what a mantra is or what, you know, anything. They don't know who Krishna is or Ganesh in their doorway. It doesn't matter. But they're intensely empathetic. They're intensely, you know, charitable or kind or just a good friend. And that's what I'm starting to feel like spirituality is, because if it's not leading to that, I do think it's worthless. Then it's just costumes and fetishes and it's, you're trying to find a personality through cultural appropriation.
Oh no, there's an awful lot of that. And this is what, you know, Trungpa writes about as spiritual materialism.
Right, exactly.
It's essentially like, hey man, I know how to meditate because I got the ropes.
Right.
Yeah. You know, and I got a great cushion. Look at my cushion.
Right.
You know, I can sit there for hours. It's so comfortable. It's the best cushion.
Right.
There is this other level though that I think seems to be happening now. And I'm wondering if you're seeing the same thing.
Yeah.
Where, because let's see, there's what, 9% of the workforce now meditates.
Uh-huh. Wow, is that right?
It's real.
Wow.
37 million Americans do yoga.
Wow, yeah.
Right?
Uh-huh.
30% of the country, adults, I guess, have done some kind of psychedelic.
Uh-huh.
Right? A lot of folks are opening to this different way of seeing reality.
Right.
Which is, you know, essentially not a materialist way.
Right.
Which is not what the mainstream of the society acknowledges.
Right.
And you don't see, like, you see this stuff covered in the New York Times. It's totally dismissive.
Totally. It drives me crazy how dismissed it is, and especially the New York Times.
At the same time, even the writers themselves may not believe it when they write it, but they know that their editors...
It's the in-house style. They have to dismiss
you
it.
You got to do it,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So there's this kind of, on the one hand, more and more people having direct experiences
right. That
are outside of religion, traditional religions, but outside traditional lineages even,
yep.
right? Where, you know, if you're a... if you're meditating at work because you think it's going to help you reduce your stress,
yeah,
and you're just doing the practice, and after a year or so, you stick with it and you go deeper with it, you're going to start to see light
yeah.
with your eyes closed.
Yeah.
And then you're going to wonder what that is.
Right.
Right? And often the teachers who are teaching those classes don't know because they haven't gone there.
Right.
Right.
Right. Right.
Right. So there's something that's going on where a lot of people, and we're seeing this just... you know, just because of the kind of stuff that I do, we're kind of like a magnet for people who are having those kinds of wake up moments, these crack in the sky things.
Right.
It feels like the conversation shifts. You can talk more publicly about these kinds of experiences than you used to even just a few years ago.
Oh, yeah. Right? Yeah. Yeah.
You can say ayahuasca and people know what you're talking about. When you did it in 2007 or whatever.
Yeah.
How many people even knew what it was?
I was obsessed with this idea of how do you talk about this publicly and should you?
Interesting.
And I actually wrote and sold a book to a major publisher. And I didn't feel like my editor, A, understood the book, nor was going to take care of me through the thickets of the publicity. Mm-hmm. Because I knew that Fox News would do, you know, sitcom star advocates hallucinogenic use. Like, that would be the headline.
Totally.
And there was no way to avoid that. But then I just quietly kept doing it and kept, you know.
So you mentioned it in the book.
The whole book was almost about ayahuasca. The whole 75% of the book was about ayahuasca. Yeah.
I hadn't gotten the book yet.
No, the book is never published.
Wait a minute.
No, I pulled it. I didn't do
it. Oh, no. So this
I returned the advance and I never published the book.
I saw an excerpt, a paragraph or something.
There is no paragraph.
There was some coverage of it. I found online.
I don't know. I think
it
leaked that it was being published.
Yes.
Like right when I was at Sundance one year, it was like this really weird thing, but... I had already decided to return the advance and not publish. I'm doing another book where I do mention it a little bit, but it is much easier. I used to, people, even on podcasts would say, can we talk about the ayahuasca? And I go, let's not. And now I talk about it freely because so many people have done it. And I did so much of it that I, you know, my early experiences with it, I was such a zealot around it. And I was such, and I think this is one of the things that I always tell people is like, do 10 to 15 ceremonies before you talk about it publicly. Because when you do one and want to write about it, you preach with the enthusiasm of the newly converted, but there's so many more lessons. Like when people say, I'm doing it again, what can you tell me? I say, the only thing I tell you is 100% it'll be different. It's just going to be different. So if you get your sample size a little larger, you can actually start to make sense of what that thing is and what, you know. And I'm well over 100 ceremonies and I don't know what it is.
Oh, well,
I don't know. I mean, yeah. it my certainty has been so eroded around what I think that thing is what is. I mean, I understand the benefit because I do feel like it's really important, especially for people saturated in the kind of material West, to have non-material amplification of consciousness experiences that are that take you out of the material realm, that show you that you're not your body and your mind. You know, mm-hmm. there's something way bigger going on. And I think that's invaluable. I noticed the more I meditated and the more psychedelics I did, I didn't cease to fear pain, bodily pain. I still fear that. But I stopped fearing death in a pretty profound way. Like I stopped thinking that my own extinction was a horror level event. Like, I just don't believe that I'm going to be fully done after this.
I am so with you.
Yeah.
And part of that was the experiences I had with ayahuasca around the time of my mother's death,
mm-hmm.
which was profound and a long story, which I'm not
going to dive
into here particularly. But it was so clear when she was going at that point that this was a transition.
Yeah. And interestingly, the DMT, the active ingredient in ayahuasca, is we release it from our pineal gland but never more so than at birth and death. So the pineal gland floods the baby's brain with DMT and floods the dying person's brain with DMT. So I think that's why they call it the vine of death, that it approximates or comes close to the transitory kind of, you know, the bardos and all this stuff.
Well, it certainly opens up the kind of the what seem to be clear walls between these different states.
Yeah.
And introduces this more, you know, the invisible aspect of existence.
Yeah. And then I also, you know, I was kind of agnostic about spirits, ghosts, whatever. And then you know, with the right healthy dose, you step into a world that's very populated. And it's not populated with bodies. It's populated with entities or spirits. And it can be alarming. And some of them don't entirely feel benevolent, but a lot do, you know, and just feeling like, oh, there's a lot more going on. What's that, Horatio? There's a lot more than is dreamt of in your philosophy.
Oh, yeah.
Heaven and earth. You know, that Hamlet line.
Mm-hmm.
But it does feel like that's almost a psychedelic line.
Well, this is the thing, is that in our society, where we're raised to be so materialist and so cut off from that aspect of what it is to be on the planet.
Yeah.
It took psychedelics. It took ayahuasca, frankly.
Yeah.
To get me to even begin to recognize that possibility.
Totally.
Because I was so cut off.
Yeah.
I was completely a secular materialist at such a, you know, extreme level that even when I began to drink the plant medicine and it began to show me things, little bits and pieces of like that would get revealed, it was done in a strategic way almost to kind of move me past one barrier of resistance to the next.
There's a kind of course plan.
Right,
like
exactly.
It's scheduled. It's a progressive revelation.
Yeah.
And it seems to pick
Sneaky
up where you
smart.
Left off at the last ceremony. And it's really strange.
Oh, massively like that.
For me, what was really interesting was I think what happened to me, I was so in love with acting and that the theater was my church. And I achieved a certain level of success that I thought would eradicate despair from my life. And in fact, the experience of being known, of being more visible, it's never how you want it to be or how you think it's going to be. And all you're focused on is the people that don't get you or, you know, you go a little crazy. So it actually amplifies your despair. And it can. I mean, most people, I think, who've been through that would echo some version of that it didn't solve anything. In fact, it brought on more problems. And the other thing is the circle of people you can complain to about it is very small. You can only complain to other people who are on a hit television show because none of your other actor friends want to hear you complain, right?
Yeah, exactly. No, so, and everybody else thinks it's self-indulgent.
Yeah.
It's like, come on, you got everything you want.
You got it all.
On,
shouldn't you be happy?
You're right.
And I think there was a reason that we filmed two seasons of How I Met Your Mother, and I found myself in a kind of depression. It wasn't like a clinical depression. It was like a deep melancholy, you know? And I wrapped season two, and couple hours later, I was on a plane to Brazil.
Really?
Yeah, I just went right. I skipped the wrap party. I went right in.
Whoa!
And I had this very funny experience where I was feeling the mother energy so strongly because it's always been except for one ceremony I had, like it was a real masculine kind of presence. It's always been this feminine madre kind of energy.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on the beach in Brazil, and I just remember going, "How I met." Like the big mother. And I realized like the title of my show had this like grand idea behind it, almost like a matriarchal energy to it, you know?
It was coming in at just the right moment.
Yeah,
the divine feminine is entering the consciousness of the culture.
And I was at the center of it. It was really...
It's not father's knows best.
Exactly. Exactly. The word mother was... And I think that in some weird... I hope no weird outlet picks this up and runs with this headline. But in some weird way, I always felt that there was a percolating kind of new thing going on at the because it's hard for me to understand why that show was and continues to be so popular, even though I kind of get it. But I think that's part of it. Is it's like it just had a feminine heart.
That's beautiful.
You know what I mean?
I love that.
Yeah.
No, well, this is how these things emerge in the culture.
Yeah.
Actually,
yeah.
Because they're like, you know, artists have these antenna.
Mm-hmm.
And you pick things up that just feels right. It resonates in the body.
Yeah. Like, you know that Leonard Schlein book? I haven't read it, but I picked it up. I think it's called Art and Physics.
Yes, sure.
Yeah. The idea that artists will actually get a hit and start writing, making things that the physicists and the scientists will then, or they're happening kind of simultaneously.
Artists are picking up vibrations of what's happening in the culture at a deep level.
Yeah.
And they know what it feels like in their body. And they're then expressing it through their work.
Yeah.
Right? And
yeah.
they're saying, this is what I see. And the mother is stepping forward. And there's certain meditation and consciousness things that sort of slip into the popular
yeah,
culture.
And that's all part of like the Aquarian prophecy, you know, the destruction of the patriarchy, the rise of kind of matriarchal, the feminine face of God on the ascendant, all this stuff
totally.
Is really happening. And you can see it. That's why it's freaking people out.
Yeah.
These structures are collapsing, you know, structures like the movie studios, governments, Catholic Church, like all these things are, it's part of the deal. It's part of what's happening.
It's huge right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can feel it
and,
shaking.
And it's really rattling people who are so in this kind of Piscean mindset mm-hmm. because they're, you know, and you have Obama who was really quite an Aquarian president. I mean, he had a real balanced masculine and feminine,
oh,
which
yeah.
people aren't used to seeing, which is so beautiful. Mm-hmm. For people who were attuned to it, it's beautiful. And then you elect this guy who's like, this Piscean nightmare, you know, to kind of like, because yeah. it snaps back.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, for me, and I think for a lot of people, there's this some, and this is going back to the idea of so many people meditating and doing yoga. I think there's this collective sense that hasn't been totally articulated, but some people are talking about it. And I try to talk about it, that the old model is simply not working. People are in despair. If you're talking about how many people are addicted to pain medication, you got to talk about why is there so much pain. And that's not just obviously physical pain. That's a deep psychic pain. What is going on? Why, you know, and not to demonize people who are on antidepressant or anti-anxiety medication, but why is there so much need for it? Why is it so hard to be alive right now? Why is there so much acute agony to the basics of living?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think we've been divorced from community. You know, I think we're tribal creatures. Like, I always get so happy. I would get so happy on those ayahuasca retreats because I'd be in nature with a group of people. You know what I mean? And I'd start to feel like, I think this is how we're supposed to be, taking our meals together, you know, praying right. together.
Right.
You know.
And feeling viscerally that connection
yeah.
to nature.
Yeah.
Which, you know, even, you know, I spent a bunch of time in the suburbs when I was in high school. I never had that feeling of nature in my body somehow mm-hmm. because it just wasn't part of my cultural framing.
Yeah.
But with the plant medicine, I got that.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
It kind of reacquaints you with your primal connection with trees and plants and dirt. And
yeah.
You know what I mean? It really does.
No, totally. So what I'm so with you about what's happening at yeah. this moment in history.
Yeah. And I think that's why ayahuasca and other psychedelics are emerging and kind of having a moment, you know, because it also feels like when the natural world is being destroyed with such haste and recklessness that they're, of course, there, you know, these ambassadors from the plant kingdom would try to reach out and make contact. I mean, it's almost like an alien movie, like they're making contact.
This is literally, I feel this is literally what's happening.
Yeah.
Is that the plant kingdom is knocking on the door
totally.
Of us stupid apes.
Yeah.
Going, pay attention.
Yeah.
Do you realize that your gut biome is mostly bacteria that is not part of your body?
Right.
That you're part of this ecosystem
right.
in a deep way?
Right.
And if you screw it all up, for everybody else, you're screwing yourselves.
Yeah.
Pay attention.
Yeah.
And the plants are just like, you know, ayahuasca's coming out of the jungle.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't here that long. You know, you don't have to go back very far before it was unavailable.
Yeah.
You could not get ayahuasca in the States.
1950s or 1940s?
No, yeah, in the 70s,
yeah.
80s.
I mean, but didn't Burroughs go down and all? Was it Burroughs or?
William yeah. Burroughs in the
50s. The Yaya letters, yeah.
Yeah. So he went. Because one other American that he knew of had done this, and he had
right.
read, he was an academic, I think it was Richard Schultes from Harvard.
Right, right.
And he's like, I got to check this out.
Yeah.
So he went on the journey, And he went down and he did, he found ayahuasca and he did not have a good time.
Right. Right. I remember reading it. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
He did not encourage anybody else to do it.
Yeah.
And he never went and did it again.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Several years later, Ginsberg went to Mexico, I believe it was Mexico, and found it and did it once.
Yeah.
Right. Ginsberg actually credited it for sort of a breakthrough for him, for himself. But he never did it again either. And they certainly never encouraged anybody else to go do it. It just seemed like the farthest thing out you could possibly do is like, no, man, don't do that. Do mescaline. Do, LSD. Yeah.
I'm much more cautious about encouraging people to do it these days, just because I don't think everyone. I like exploring my mind. I just do. You know, I'm curious what's behind this door. You know, what's the crevice? And some people, I think most people could benefit from some people, which would not be their thing. I wouldn't recommend my mom do it.
Well, I mean, did actually give a little to my dad once. But that said, I never advocated. I mean, despite what it might sound like on this show, today's episode.
It's a tricky thing, the proselytizing. And I also think, you know, much like yoga, meditation, anything that our human hands get on is going to get sullied. You know what I mean?
That I'm not worried about. Honestly,
I
think ayahuasca is a lot smarter than we are, and that it's figuring out how it wants to be distributed on this planet.
Right, right.
That's my own woo-woo way of looking at it.
Right.
And my even more woo-woo way of looking at it is that when it's right for you, someone, to do ayahuasca, it will come to you.
Absolutely.
It will let you know.
Absolutely. I had that experience my first time. I thought, when did this plant become interested in me?
Interesting.
Like I had this feeling that it had sought me out, but I didn't know.
How did that happen? What introduced you to
it? A friend of mine who is a screenwriter, and he's married to a friend of mine from college. And he came over one day and he told me that they had been in Mexico and they had done it. And I'd never heard the word before, but the word I found, it was so haunting to me, this word. I just kept saying it, like it lingered in my head, and then I read the Pinchbeck book, Breaking Open the Head, which was an important book to me at
cool.
the time. You know,
that's great.
Like I really, and I was reading it.
He was my co-founder of this company.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Back in the day,
that book really landed on me, and I just appreciated. You know what it was? When people write about these matters, I want the writing to be fiercely good. Because when I read about this, it's already so suspect that I at least want the writing to be fierce and grammatically correct. You know what I mean?
Totally. And he's a wonderful writer.
He's a really good writer. And, you know, I don't love everything he writes, but I think that that book was a very fascinating, you know, he threw a pebble in the water that had a lot of ripples, I think. And so I read that book. And then this woman I was seeing at the time said, do you want to... Oh, no, it wasn't. I took her, but it was another guy. It was this photographer that I knew. She said, my friend has been with this group in Brazil, and this guy, Ralph Miller, is coming to talk in Santa Monica. And so I took this woman that I was seeing, and I met this guy, Ralph. And within 5 minutes, I was like, I'm going. Like, I am going. There was no doubt. And I did two back-to-back sessions. You know, like, I was down there for 3 weeks. And
it was supposed to be 10 days and then 10 days or something.
It was like 8 or 9 days and 3 ceremonies each. And I did 6, and it was, it was so powerful. It was so powerful.
What opened you to all of this? When did you begin to get interested in spiritual exploration?
I think that I went to an Orthodox Hebrew day school in Columbus. So I did half day English, half day Hebrew. And it was a pretty intense indoctrination in a lot of ways. But there were a couple teachers there that were really asked us to really meditate on God and what that might mean. And I remember we did this one rabbi, we did this visualization of walking through the woods. And it was, you know, he took us through this whole deep, you know, on our lying down, eyes closed. He said, and suddenly you see God. What do you see? And what I saw was sunlight, you know, when rays of sunlight, it was just light came through. It wasn't an old man, wasn't no beard, you know, just light. And I remember I was just calmed by that experience. And so I never, there was never any part of me that was atheist. I just, and I can't say that I've been like a super believer, but I never, I always felt some presence with me. I don't know how to describe it. I just have never felt, even when I'm alone, I don't feel alone, you know? And I think that that has inoculated me against some level of despair, that I felt some presence that was benevolent with me. And then, like I said, I, you know, I went through puberty and I, you know, it was all about girls. And then it was all about theater. Once I discovered the theater, and that became my church or synagogue. But by the time I was in grad school and a little bit after, I started to realize that its shoulders weren't big enough to bear the weight of what I was wanting it to be or needing it to be. So the process of having what I wanted happen, which was establishing this career, you know, and it's gonna be 20 years since I got out of drama school. It is right around now, about 20 years. So I've been making my living as an actor for 20 years, which is statistically improbable.
That doesn't happen often.
No, and it's this incredible thing. So I'm really taking this moment to pinch myself. Like, this is pretty great. But at the same time, I did reach a limit of the worship of it, as it was revealed to be not quite a false god, but it couldn't. I needed something bigger and more magnificent and more mysterious to I don't know, bow to or turn my attention to.
So beyond the acting profession, or beyond the making of movies, TV, theater, like the whole.
Yeah,
like,
well, where, in some ways, I still look at creativity as my spiritual practice. I actually taught a course at Esalen with my friend David Newman called Creativity as a Spiritual Practice.
Oh, really?
It was great. Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
yeah. Wow. But I do look at, you know, I'm a songwriter now and I have a band with my friend Ben Lee, and playing music feels incredibly spiritual. Music has always been a portal for me, which is why ayahuasca also has been so powerful, because of the music.
Is, right, and you know, Ben Lee did an album called Ayahuasca.
Yes, yes, yes. I brought him to the world.
You did?
I did that.
Congratulations.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's
he
awesome.
Was my friend, and I brought him over there.
That's sweet. We traded some emails around the time the album came out, and I think we did something about
really?
It on our magazine.
Oh,
Reality
cool.
Sandwich.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think it's a great album.
It's a great album.
Yeah, it's really good. And making movies is a very spiritual practice for me. Writing is very spiritual. And yet, you know, they've been complementary. It was more, in some ways, I think I started meditating because I wanted anxiety relief. I was an anxious person, and being an actor wasn't helping, you know, like I was just nervous. And so meditating helped calm me on some level. But then once I had these experiences that felt more like a fusion with something larger than myself, which was grand and beautiful and a relief, I then started to go, I think there's more, like way more going on here. So then ayahuasca, I suppose you could say, like, it was part of this attempt to get me out of this melancholy that had descended around being on this hit show. but more, it was this highway you know, this incredible sphere of reality that not a lot of people get to visit. And I was so startled by it. I was so startled that it existed. I mean, it does have the feel of a fairy tale, like you went to Oz, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like,
totally.
or even, you know, I always tell people about ayahuasca. I said, here's what I think is one of the best things about it. And really any psychedelic is, if you go to a church, they'll say, oh, these great men, mostly men, had these experiences. And you just have to take our word for it. This is what they brought back. Ayahuasca says, you are Buddha under the tree. You are Jesus in the desert. And to some people, to like an evangelical Christian, that would sound heretical. You'd be like, no, that's not for us. You know, don't eat the fruit of the, you know. But ultimately, I feel like I can only own it if I've experienced it myself. And you know, I've had intensely powerful experiences where I felt that I was being asked to really make consequential choices. That you know, where you're like, oh, there are two paths ahead of me right now. I had my friend Trent, my buddy, who's I've done a lot of medicine with. He said to me after a ceremony, he goes, I walked down every wrong hallway that night. He goes, I literally opened every wrong door and walked down every hallway. He goes, I didn't make a single right move.
Oh my God.
The whole night.
I have had nights like that.
Yeah.
I know what that's like.
You're just playing catch up. But
at the same time, what hit me was once I started to understand that I could have those kinds of experiences for myself, I realized, whoa, there is not a person on the planet who is not capable of having that experience, direct experience. And that propaganda that basically says that that experience is not available to you because for whatever reason, whether it's the, in the certain texts, they say the evangelical texts, well, that period is over, certain people were prophets, that's not happening anymore.
Yeah.
This idea that essentially that this core part of what it is to be human and to be divine, to understand yourself as divine.
Entheogen, to reveal the divine within.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That it's something that should not be made available to everybody.
Yeah.
It's criminal to me.
It absolutely. And I think Terence McKenna articulates this the best in terms of the power structures wanting to keep you from doing this, because at a certain point, like, you know, if you spend enough time in ayahuasca space and then you read the Washington Post, you'll be like, this is madness, or Fox News, God forbid. You know what I mean? It's madness. The arms race is madness. What we're doing to the climate is madness. But because we're so saturated in it, it starts to feel like, well, this is just how life is. But ayahuasca seems to promise some other way of being that is so magical. And it just sits in your heart in a different way, like a more beautiful way. Like my friend Charles Eisenstein has a book called The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible.
I've done a lot of stuff with Charles Eisenstein.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I'm one of several people who take credit for this, but I edited Sacred Economics.
Oh, I love Sacred Economics. Yeah. I think about that book often.
Oh, brilliant.
I really do. I recommend it to a lot of people.
Awesome. We published the entire book, chapter by chapter, on Reality Sandwich, our magazine.
I remember that.
Oh, that's great.
Oh, I was a big Reality Sandwich reader. Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
That's awesome. Okay, that's my
Adam magazine. Ellenboss is a friend of mine.
Oh, Adam? Of course, very well.
Yeah.
I edited Fishers of Men. I can actually take credit for that.
Okay. I love that book. Yeah. I reached out to Adam after he wrote up this prayer for the... Remember the Sweat Lodge deaths?
Yes, of course.
He wrote this prayer that I thought was so compassionate. And he even prayed for the leader of it. You know what I mean? Like there was something that was so moving to me about it. And I think I just emailed him and we became friends.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
He's a lovely guy.
I haven't talked to him in a while. And he has kids now.
Yeah, he's got two kids. Yeah. And married to a beautiful herbalist, Ashley.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, Sacred Economics, I think a lot about, you know, just this idea of in every sacred text, it outlaws usury. It outlaws interest-bearing economy. But if you tell people today, like, oh, you know, this is actually immoral. This is like this, you know, it creates debtor class. It creates exactly what happens. The wealth gets concentrated up here and everyone else suffers. And people will be like, you can't question capitalism. That's like Richard Rohr, who's this Franciscan priest who I love. Do you know Richard Rohr?
His I don't actually.
Work is brilliant.
Uh-huh.
But he says anytime a structure or an institution becomes too big to criticize, there's probably evil going on.
Totally.
So the banks, the church, the military industrial complex, the government, you know, things that are kind of above. Mm-hmm. And he said, if you're going to be preaching the gospel, truly preaching the gospel, you have to critique capitalism. But if you critique capitalism, people will say, Father, you're getting a little political. And he said, well, how do you talk about the gospel without critiquing the system that seems to be antithetical to the whole deal, you know?
Totally. No, so, you got to go there.
And I thought that's what Charles' book was doing. It was providing like this, and it was a historical context. Like, I never even understood like just the experiments with non-interest-bearing currency. Like, that fascinated me, you know? I don't know. I miss Reality Sandwich. I was really there quite a bit.
Oh, we're still doing it.
Oh, you are?
Yeah, a little less frequently because frankly, we're distracted.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, I know. But when I was discovering medicine, that was a very reliable place to feel like there was a community out there beyond the one I knew.
Brilliant.
That there were other people. That's why I reached out to Adam. And I forget if that's how I started reading Charles there. But I knew Stella, his wife.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
And we did her book,
LA.
Too. We also published her book.
I read her book, which is great. She sent me an early copy of that.
Oh, sweet.
So I got to know Charles through her. But I do think that there are... Charles is a voice that I tell people, like, check in with Charles Eisenstein. I love that Oprah had him on because I think he's such a big thinker, you know, and he's such a visionary.
Yeah. No, you know? He resonates deep. And I think he sees through stuff.
He's a terrific diagnostician. You know, like, he really... can diagnose collectively, like what's going on and where we're hurting and where we're off. And he's got a bit, and he marries some, he's got a heart to it, you know?
Totally. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. No, he's can't say enough good things about Charles.
Yeah.
The, what I think is happening at the moment, which I think Charles would probably agree with on some level, is all of the diagnostics, I think, how thoroughly fucked up everything is, I think you're on target.
Yeah.
But something else is also happening simultaneously, right? And that is the emergence of this new, well, Charles would call it a new story.
Right.
I would say, or other people, you know, you can talk about it. Essentially, it's a cultural movement. It's a consciousness culture.
Yeah.
Where people are getting turned on, mm-hmm. and it may be because the plants are doing it, but or something in the field is doing it.
Right.
But there's this sense of people shifting their own understanding of what's important
right.
in life.
Right.
Away from the materialist, you know, consumerist, corporatist sense of success.
Yeah.
Towards something that's deeper.
Yeah.
And if that doesn't happen, if people somehow don't connect to their own inner connection to source, where the real satisfaction is,
yeah,
and move away from this endless consumption
mode,
we're done. It's the only thing that actually is going to make the big difference.
That's why when people try to relegate like plant medicine to some like hippie 60s resurgence, like I said, no. This is part of the salvation of the planet. I mean, it sounds so grand to say that, but you got to stand behind that because it's true. If you don't give people a non-materialist kind of opening, it's, you know, we'll just devour ourselves. We're already doing it. So there's an urgency to the moment. And I don't know if that means, you know, one of the things that a lot of people say when they first drink ayahuasca, I certainly said, is like, we need to get every politician in the world to drink this. Like, that's such a common kind of first, because you have that heart explosion. And in that place, you're like, war? Who could ever declare war on people? You know,
totally.
It feels like madness. And you kind of wake up from the disease of slumber that we're all under. So I think it's a big deal. Now, I think it has to be, I don't think you can just do ayahuasca and dance in the jungle. I think there's more to be done, you know. I love this. Terrence McKenna has this thing about, you know, when you're in the psychedelic experience, you're like a fisherman out on the high seas of consciousness, and you lower your nets. And he said you're not looking for little minnows that will, you know, like, oh, your pinky fits exactly into your nose, like little things that are meaningless. And he said, you're not looking for ideas so big that they're going to sink the boat. He said, you're looking for medium-sized fish, like medium-sized ideas that you can take back and have fish dinner with the folks on shore, like that you can actually bring back. And that's what I found, you know. I've talked, before my parents knew that I did ayahuasca, I would share with them things that I had learned without telling them the source. And they never looked at me like I was crazy. They would say, wow, that's really beautiful. But I didn't tell them, like, a plant told me this. You know what I mean? Like, I just told them, like, hey, I've been thinking about this thing. And they're like, wow, that's really wonderful. You know, and that was part of the reason I didn't publish the book was I felt like I actually had something to say that I didn't want the message to get lost in, you know, TV star does, you know, advocates hallucinogens.
So how do you bring that back? How do you bring that out now through the work that you're doing? Do you feel like you're dropping little
I always try
moments?
To. I mean, there's a character that Zac Efron plays in my second film, Liberal Arts, and he's wearing a Shipibo Indian shirt and a Peruvian hat. He never says ayahuasca. He never says plants, but he's the ayahuasca of the movie because he's always trying to get the main character to connect with his heart and get out of his head. And he's, you know, so there's certain things like that that are, I can drop in a movie and I don't have to feel like I'm a polemicist or trying to have some political agenda, mm-hmm. you know? I try to make movies that are about love and kindness on some level, or at the very least redemption, you know, salvation. It's so interesting. I was raised Jewish, but I find myself super attracted to these very Christian words like mercy, grace, and forgiveness are just like words that really resonate with my heart. And so I try to make art that touches on those things. And then I started a couple years ago, Ben urged me to do it, to start doing a newsletter. And I thought it would be the thing that I, Brett sent to you. I call them newsletters, or someone called them newsletters. It kind of stuck. But I do like a monthly or bi-monthly newsletter, and a lot of people get them. And I just write about where I am, you know? And the last one that you read was about me feeling kind of blah and uninspired. And it got such a great response because people, I think that the Instagram culture makes everyone think that everyone looks great and has it all together, while everyone really feels rotten or less than inspired at the very least. And to have someone who has some visibility and looks like, I bet he's happy. I bet that guy from How I Met Your Mother, he's probably happy.
You would assume, like, right?
You'd assume, of course. And for me to say like, no, I'm actually having a hard time, and this is how I deal with it when I have these hard times. And if people who are listening want to sign up, you can go to my Instagram page. It's in the bio, the link. But I love relating to people this way because it makes me feel less alone. And I think it makes it helps other people feel less alone. And I think that one of the good uses of celebrity is to help people feel less alone in their suffering. It's not all to just distract them from their hardship. A lot of times it's saying like, you know, I hurt too. I'm having a hard time, and I'm going to say this publicly. I heard some NPR, like This American Life, about these parents, a husband had this regressive brain disease. It was terrible. Like he just regressed to a child, and it's very rare. And she made a comment. She said, no celebrities or celebrities' children have this, so it doesn't get a lot of funding or attention. And you realize that, like, it's horrible for anyone to get stricken with any disease, but like when a Michael J. Fox gets Parkinson's, it can move the needle. You know what I mean? And I read this thing, I think Meg Ryan said this thing, like when a light is shining on you, move close to the things that also need a light shone on them, you know? And I'm still figuring out exactly what that is. I have certain charities that I adore and support really robustly in my own private way, and I try to let people know about them. I think some people know that I'm into plants and meditation. You know, uh-huh. I've had people that I didn't know, you know, like at big parties be like, I need to talk to you, you know? And I'd be like, I didn't know you knew me. And they're like, I want to do ayahuasca. What do I do? So I think I became like a little bit of an ambassador, you know, people talk, but.
Well, you know, it doesn't exist yet to the best of my knowledge.
What's that?
The movie about. And you know this guy. I know this. We meet these guys all the time. The C-level guy who was like totally locked into doing the corporate thing.
Yeah.
And then they have the knock on the door moment when things are not working and they go to Peru and they change their life.
Right. You know, it's hard. I found that the psychedelic experience is so, even, you know, like what was that? Blueberry. You've seen that clip from Blueberry, that psychedelic Western.
Oh, yeah. Right.
I mean, it
okay.
kind
yeah,
of
yeah.
gets a little close,
mm-hmm.
but it's not just a visual thing. There's a consciousness that has taken over your body and is communicating through your brain.
It's not about the visuals at all.
Right.
Ultimately, even though you have these incredible personal visions, maybe you right. do, you don't. At a certain point, I don't know about you, but at a certain point for me, I realized, let go of the spectacular vision because it's actually keeping me from going deeper.
The vision, sometimes you have to say like, enough. I need to get to the truth of what's going on because sometimes they can be so overwhelming and so distracting and gorgeous.
Gorgeous, but also a little bit sensational.
The production design is off the hook.
It's fantastic.
But I wondered, I tried to write something that I just got stuck on, but it was about a kind of disgraced movie studio exec who ends up kind of having a psychedelic experience without, it's unexplained. I mean, he just is in the woods and, you know, it's just this strange, mystical experience. And I was never able to quite crack it. And I wonder sometimes, rather than being literal about a mystical experience, which sounds like a contradiction, but if it's better to find an analogous kind of story that you can tell, you know, like Groundhog Day, for instance, is like a very trippy, psychedelic movie without saying like, oh, he really must have taken something. You know what I mean?
Right, that's true, for
yeah.
real.
Yeah.
But there's also something about, and this sort of falls into what, you know, the Charles Eisenstein idea of the new story.
Yeah.
Like, there are these archetypal stories that when they hit the culture, sometimes become the avenue for conversation so that people understand that a particular path, a particular action that they take is available to them.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so that's the thing which I'm seeing so much of in terms of, you know, people who are accomplished, successful, intelligent, educated, well-to-do folks in the world, understanding that their life path is really a disaster and that they're contributing to something that's not doing anybody
any
good.
Absolutely.
And they're getting their own private wake-up moment.
Uh-huh.
And they're going down that road and they're coming out. I mean, I guess it's a little bit eat, pray, love if you do it in a gentle, soft way, but there's something else that goes, to me, more interesting and can be way deeper.
And I also think some of the old, some of these ancient perennial stories actually provide a map, like, you know, the Odyssey, like the trying to get home, you know, with series of trials when you're trying to get home, or, you know, the seven trials of Hercules or whatever. Those can feel psychedelic. I mean, you can feel, you have nights where you're like, you had seven trials. You know what I mean?
For real.
And I think there's something, even, the, you know, the life of Jesus or the life of Abraham or Moses, you know, the burning bush is a deeply psychedelic story. There's an Israeli psychologist named Benny Shannon who proposed, do you know this theory? He thought that, or he proposed quite convincingly that the Israelites were under the spell of an ayahuasca-like thing. The acacia tree, which is mentioned all over the Bible, has DMT in it.
Right.
And so there were these, you know, pagan cults that would use plants, probably. So, I've had my version of the golden calf and the burning bush and the parting of the Red Sea, all that stuff. I've been there.
Oh yeah, well that's the power of having these kinds of experiences. And just to say, they don't only have to happen with plant medicine or with psychedelics.
Yeah,
they can happen because you're doing other kinds of spiritual work. You're going deep into meditation.
Yeah.
It's just
you can have a life-threatening experience that
all kinds of things can knock you into that other space.
Yeah,
near-death experiences can certainly do that.
Yeah,
which is whole.
Those are astonishing too. The NDEs,
wild.
Yeah.
So it's all part of this kind of continuum of spiritual experience that we just don't give credit to or credence to in our culture.
Yeah.
Which, you know, for me, it was the psychedelic thing, the ayahuasca thing that opened me up to understand that was even possible, that all these things were possible.
The thing for me that I found at a certain point, I was doing it so much that I started to feel that I knew what my homework was. You know, you get homework, like quite literally, like, you got to apologize to this person.
Mm-hmm.
You got to, you know what I mean? Like,
yes.
Like just like, oh, you know, you got to stop eating that food. It's not good for your system. You can feel it. All those things. Mm-hmm. I started to, my homework wasn't changing. And I think that I stepped away. I just did a ceremony like in November, but I hadn't done one for 3 years. And it was good for me. It was good for me because I had to integrate and I had to, Ram Dass tells that great story about when he gave Neem Karoli Baba the acid, he gave it to him twice and nothing happened to him. He was with him for 12 hours both times, nothing happened to him. And he asked him about it and Neem Karoli Baba said, it's good medicine. He said, it can take you into the room with Christ, but you're not allowed to stay there. And I thought, I've really meditated on that. Like I have had experience, I am saturated with the oneness of the universe. Like absolutely fused with the one. I've also been in hell. You know what I mean? Like it's been all over the place. But those fusion experiences where you're at like the eighth level of heaven, like where you're it's just so holy, you can't even believe it. And then you come back and there's always a little bit of sadness when your ego restructures itself. And you're like, oh, I guess I want to do a crossword puzzle, you know, like, or whatever you know, or your habits or whatever. Coffee. I think I should start drinking coffee again. And, but I think that it then becomes about diligence and about
The integration.
The integration and about what's the word I'm looking for? Just being vigilant with yourself about, okay, I'm not in a ceremonial space right now, but Jack Kornfield has that great book, After the Ecstasy, the Laundry.
Right.
Which is just, that's the phrase, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you just have to do the laundry.
Well, you always got to do the laundry.
You always got to do the laundry.
Yeah, that's sometimes you have the ecstasy.
Right.
The ecstasy doesn't happen as often as laundry.
But there's a sadness to doing laundry after the ecstasy. because you think there's some part of your brain that's like, I'm going to hold on to this forever and ever and I'll never be the same.
I know, but the trick is actually discovering the ecstasy in the laundry.
That's right. And I think that's what any proper kind of Zen teacher would be, you know, teaching.
And honestly, I mean, listen, everybody's different, but in my ayahuasca experiences, I was taught how to find the laundry as ecstatic.
Mm-hmm.
So it can happen in the right context in a ceremony, but everybody's different and everybody gets access to different things. Ultimately, for me, working with plant medicine was a training in how to connect with spirit guides, with energetic beings that are, you know, out there.
Yeah.
But they're not out there. They're in you. Right. And you don't know how to find them.
Right.
Because the way our society presents this aspect of existence, you ignore all of that. Even when they start knocking on the door going, pay attention to me, pay attention to me, you walk the other way.
Well, because there's so much that's also saying, pay attention to me, pay attention to me.
Which the society actually values.
Yeah.
This stuff, the society doesn't value because it says to you, basically, you're out of your mind. If you pay attention to that, you're crazy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But if you pay attention to like, oh, get that Cadillac,
it's
like, oh, you're a really smart guy.
It's so crazy how we just value this consumption as if it's some, I don't know, like it's really nuts.
It's really nuts.
Yeah.
Brett asked me to ask you a question.
Sure.
When are you going to do your high school movie? Are you writing it?
I was just talking to Jesse, my producer, who's Brett's dear friend. Yeah, we were talking about that because I think Brett would want to be involved. You know, like there's people that really want to, you know, would want me to make a movie in Columbus, Ohio, which I shot liberal arts in Gambier, Kenyon, where I went to school, and we shot a couple days in Columbus. But there's a really, Columbus is a great town.
It is.
Yeah, it's a great town, and it's a lot cooler than when we grew up there. It's really exploded.
It is actually surprisingly cool. To a New York guy who like showed up there yesterday for the first time, and I'm like walking around going, there's a lot going on here.
Yeah.
The largest gay population outside of San Francisco.
Oh, is that right?
Somebody yesterday told me there's a bigger gay population
in Columbus.
It might be
Columbus. Per capita. Look into that.
Maybe
it might
it's
be per capita. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah,
well, that's possible. I was thinking about New York and LA. Is like, is that
the
possible?
The art scene, the music, the food is terrific. Like it's a really great town. It's kind of a fun town to be from, you know, and I like returning. But to Brett, if you're listening, I'm on it. I'm doing my best. But I've got so many projects going. I'm trying. Yeah.
That's the worst excuse. Josh, thanks so much.
Oh man, this was a real treat.
Really loved having you here.
All right, yeah. Thanks so much.
I want to thank Josh Radner for joining us, and you too for being with us. You can follow Josh on Twitter at Josh Radner, that's RADNOR, and sign up for his newsletter there. I want to thank our producer, Jose Alfaro, and the ACAST team. Our theme music is Measure by Measure by Paul D. Miller, a.k.a. DJ Spooky, from his album, The Secret Song. And our interstitial music are tracks by The Human Experience. Sunu, from the album Soul Visions with Rising Appalachia, and Here for a Moment on the album Gone, Gone Beyond. Go check them out. That's all for now. We'll be back next week.
Find the others.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.